from the Hill Country in Texas, broadcasting worldwide, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Here's your host, Patrick Timpone.
Sorry for the delay, Real World of Money fans. We were all ready to go. I poured some hot water to a big glass for tea, and it cracks. It just starts leaking on the desk. They should do, don't they do instructions, Andrew Goss, for pouring tea like that? Don't pour it into a glass, hot water. I don't know. Well, I don't know. It is March 21st. It's the second day of spring, and it's a Wednesday, and Andrew Goss is back up in Jersey for the summer. However, you are now greeted by global warming falling out of the sky. Well, isn't that good? Isn't that just good?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Aren't you glad?
That's what I was looking forward to, yeah.
Come up to Jersey for the summer, and oops, it's global warming coming out of the sky. When did you get back, Andrew Goss, to Jersey?
Late yesterday.
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, just in time, huh? You just,
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
just in time.
Only one reason to be here.
That's right. Only one reason to be here. Andrew Goss is a currency historian. His company is SDL. They hang out in Hawthorne, New Jersey, and also Hilton Head. And he tries to, you know, go with the weather and be a snowbird. And now he's a snower. I don't even know what they call it. Andrew, I am...
Yeah, I'm a guy in mesh shoes with no socks. It's snowing.
That's right. Got your shorts and got golf clubs in the garage and say, hey, well, I don't know. I'm about a third of the way, or two-thirds of the way through the first season of an Amazon Prime exclusive. Don't you love it how they're exclusive now, right?
Oh, sure.
And this one is The Man in the High Castle.
Ooh, that's a pretty good one.
Did you see that one?
Yeah, I know. I've heard a lot about it. I caught an episode, I guess, about a year ago.
Oh, it's kind of interesting. It's a... It takes place in the 60s, and it turns out that Germany and
Japan
are running the United States, and the Fuhrer is still living in Germany.
And they're running the world, aren't they?
Yeah, they're running the world. That's correct. And they somehow haven't got to that part, how they did it, but they convinced Americans that they won the war, right?
Right.
And they did it because... Well, I guess they controlled the television or something, because the underground, you know, the resistance is out there, and they're finding these old newsreels of VJ Day and, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the real things of Ike and, you know, the whole thing of winning the war. And
sure.
Right. And so that's, I guess they're trying to get the films to the man in the high castle who, I don't know, he's going to...
I don't know. That's what it seemed kind of far-fetched to me, so that's why I got one episode in and moved on.
No, but it's really good. It's really
good. Sure it is.
Okay, it's really good. But it got me thinking. So, see, back in the 60s, I don't know how they pulled it off. Well, you know, I guess it would be too tough if you had three networks and a few newspapers. You own them all. I don't know. But today, you could do something like that with computers and holograms and computer technology and the internet, right? And satellites. You could pull off an entire, I mean, you really could, couldn't you? And nobody would truly know what the truth was.
Yeah, until somebody sends somebody else a text, you know, or a picture.
But I mean, couldn't you control all of that? Couldn't you control it? I don't know.
I suppose you could.
I mean, you could do a virtual war. I mean, that'd be easy enough to do, right? I mean,
yeah.
You could, right? I mean, you know,
play a war inside of a video game?
Sure.
That
sure.
No one knows about?
Sure.
Yeah, I guess you could.
Plus, I mean, there are people that conjecture that the whole moon landing thing happened because that was a whole, you know, it was a TV show.
Capricorn One?
Yeah. And who's the guy that supposedly did the 2001 Space Odyssey guy?
Stanley Kubrick.
Stanley Kubrick supposedly did the thing. And, Yeah, there are folks out there today called hoaxers, moon hoaxers, you know.
Yes.
I know.
I know.
I interviewed a guy a couple years ago, and he was quite serious, too.
Oh, yes. My friend from Passaic, he's passed away, Ralph Rene,
yeah,
wrote a book called NASA Mooned America.
Yeah.
And he was...
He was into it, huh?
Oh, man, like you wouldn't believe he was into it.
Yeah, they got a thing about, what do they call it, the Van Allen belt, the
Radiation belt, yeah.
They claim that you can't go through there, you'd burn up, you know.
Well, if you ever see the Russians' rockets,
yeah,
you'll notice that they're triple the American rockets, and the capsules were actually lead, feet of lead.
Oh, they were?
They were actually trying to protect their astronauts from the Van Allen belt radiation.
Oh, I see.
You know, I'm not a physicist.
No.
And I know that the space station is in near-Earth orbit, and when they try
to
go
below that, right?
Yeah, when they try to go any farther, the astronauts report seeing spots before their eyes and
really
things like that. Radiation is supposed to be really heavy, yeah. But again, I'm not a physicist, yeah. So.
But if you do think back to '69, and I don't know if you saw it, were you born '69?
No, I wasn't born until yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah. Well, I saw that on Facebook.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we watched it on our little television, and you could see it'd be very easy. I mean, you know, just talking for fun, it'd be very easy to stage that one, right? It was, you know, very easy, right?
Mm. My friend Kenny says, if we went to the moon in 69, how come we're not strip mining it by now?
Well, that's
his evidence.
That's a good point, right?
We're not strip mining that thing.
Well,
why not?
Elon Musk says he's going to go up there.
Good. He's going to Mars, isn't
he? He's going to Mars, yeah.
Well, it's a brave new world. Brave, brave.
Brave.
I have a hard time getting across the river to New York City, so, you know, I can not even fathom the idea.
That's right. That's
getting
right.
In a tube and shooting myself.
That's right.
Millions of light years away from Earth. I won't even leave the United States. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I get that, you know, because you got to take off your belt and your shoes. Who wants to go to Mars? Who knows? Tell me what you had to take off.
True.
You guys got to get naked because we're not sure about you.
Yeah, and we're going to seal you up in this plastic thing because I...
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So have you heard about the Austin Mad Bomber? That's quite a story, isn't
it? Yeah, did he catch him this morning?
No, I don't think so. Not that I heard.
I heard about some guy this morning blowing up in his car.
Oh,
so
good.
I didn't know if that was...
Man, I don't know what that's all about, you know.
Me neither, but it seems like fairly well organized, so I wonder if it's just one lone nut or some sort of organized thing.
Yeah.
I really can't figure it out, nor should I try. So, I've got in my own little segment of the world, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. So, yeah. Did you catch that U.S. budget deficit, fiscal 2017?
I've got to that. Oh, is this the 1.3 trillion omnibus bill?
Yeah. The net deficit
for
last year, fiscal 2017, $1.15 trillion. The trillions are flying by now like picket fences.
So that would be October 16.
Yeah.
Through October 17.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we've hit it. Now it's $21 trillion, the national debt. 20, that was just a memory, a faint memory. So $21 trillion now.
So this is on President Trump's watch, correct?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess your deficit, I mean, fiscal 2017, 1.15. Well, that's not a lot. It's about tracking what was during the Obama administration, right?
Uh-huh.
1.1,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I got some interesting figures out of this report. It's from the Treasury, so I give it a little bit of credence.
Well, we'll say a little bit.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the first chart I found the most interesting. So in the last 5 years, 80% of the revenue is individual income taxes.
You're right.
Only 9% came from corporate income taxes.
9%?
Yeah.
Wow.
80% was paid, borne by the individual.
In the last 5 years. So that would mean that then the whole corporate thing...
slashing corporate taxes?
It's not that big a deal as far as revenue loss, correct?
That's right.
It should be a net gain because of... the trickle-down stuff, right?
Well, because of the increase in payroll.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's the theory, right? Since 80% of the taxes were paid by individuals, if you cut the corporate tax rate and that increases the number of people working,
sure,
then theoretically your revenues on the 80% side will increase much more dramatically than your loss of revenue on the 9% side.
And acting as President Trump's new economic advisor, I would also say then also new people are going to come in.
That's right.
And then there are going to even be more jobs because the corporate rate is more attractive.
Right.
Apple might build in Panama rather than in
They have a secret screen factory that they've built in California. They didn't even tell anyone about.
Amazon? Apple?
Apple. Really? Yeah. Really? Which of course sent Samsung stock straight down because, you know, we've been importing the screens for the iPhones. They're made overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Now suddenly they're going to be made right here in the United States.
Also, I guess Amazon. Well, this doesn't have anything to do with the corporate, but maybe it does. Amazon, too, they're going to be going somewhere soon.
Second headquarters,
yeah. Where is that?
Who knows?
You got your Notre Dame hat on?
No, I do not. No, my bet is Southeast, the Atlanta region.
Yeah,
but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, it's kind of interesting just talking there. I wanted to lead with something else, but you got me off track, which is fine. The FANG plus A, you know, that's the new one. So we have Facebook. Apple, Google,
Amazon,
Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google plus Apple.
Right.
I saw where that comprises 25% of the NASDAQ, FANG plus A. And I was musing on Facebook. It's kind of Orwellian. I mean, someday will we just see like,
The corporation.
Do you
own stock in the corporation?
Do you own stock in the corporation? And it's not too far-fetched, right?
Because, you know, J.P. Morgan, of course, he started that we hate competition thing. And, U.S. Steel was the corporation. But what wasn't revealed so much is that number two and three and number four were all controlled by number one. So you have Visa and MasterCard, but yeah, they're the same people. You have, corporations that look like they're separate when in fact they're the same.
Oh, because you've told us about these interlocking
directorships.
That's
correct. Yeah.
So back, J.P. Morgan, stay there for a minute. They owned U.S. Steel when? When was that?
Well, he bought U.S. Steel from Andrew Carnegie. I guess that was in 1903.
JP did.
Yeah. Well, he consolidated it. Yeah. He said to Andrew Carnegie, you know, give me a number. Just give me a number.
What do you want?
Yeah, that's it. Just give me a number. I just want to know how much it is. And so Andrew Carnegie wrote what he thought was a ridiculous amount on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And JP said, done.
Done. Do we know what that amount was?
Somewhere deep in the cobwebs of this mind is the exact number. Seemed like all the money in the world at the time, but of course, JP being representative of the House of Rothschild through the Peabody firm in London had no trouble coming up with that money, whatever it was. It was a huge number, but he had no trouble coming up with it, and U.S. Steel was born. Now, today, we find ourselves being forced to protect a company like U.S. Steel because we've lost all of our steel-making capability. The 49% of the world's steel comes from China.
And even though they claim it's a mostly Canada, you said that a lot of that is coming from...
Cross shipping, whatever they want. Yeah, you know, harsh reality is you cannot have a secure country if you don't have a steel industry.
Thank you, President Trump. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you can't call China and say, hey, we're gearing up to go to war and with you guys, perhaps, and we need armor plating for our Humvees. You know, they're just not going to sell it to us. So
I think, I guess a big clump of this is going to hit on Friday, right? $60 billion in tariffs are going to be announced officially on Friday.
Let's hope.
Is that true?
I hope.
Uh-huh.
I'm hoping. And this morning I caught the 3% tax. You catch that? The EU for Amazon revenues?
No, tell us.
Oh, wow. Okay, so the way that we do things here and the way that things have been done when we were at a disadvantage was, American consumers buy billions of dollars worth of imported goods from foreign companies.
Right.
But the foreign companies are taxed in their home jurisdictions. So we, the Treasury, we don't garner any revenue when LG sells a refrigerator in the United States. Say, whatever profit LG makes is taxed in Korea. And so now whatever profit Mercedes makes is not taxed in the United States, it's taxed in Germany. But of course, Amazon has been making inroads into the European marketplace, and now the Europeans are complaining, hey, these guys are based in the United States. We don't get any tax revenue from their operations. So how about we put a 3% tax on their gross revenue for any people that buy in from Europe?
Oh, hey.
They're not putting up with it. We did for all the years. So, but now that the shoe is finally on the other foot, and we're the ones that are going to take revenue from a foreign country and have it taxed here in the United States.
They're all
Now we're all up in arms. Yeah, now all of a sudden, oh, it's unfair. So, interesting dichotomy.
And of course, then the media is going to have fun with that one. And say,
of course, it's a retaliation for Trump's.
Told you this trade war was saying. Out today, Wall Street Journal. But China's preparing to hit back with their own thing, and they're going to aim it at President Trump's support base, of course, like agricultural exports from farm belt states.
Don't eat. See if we care.
Don't eat. That's right.
See if we won't transship our grain. You don't want to buy grain from the U.S., so what if we're going to be forced to play their game and transship to another country? And, okay, you buy Canada's grain, and Canada will eat America's grain. That's ridiculous, but... that's what it'll end up being.
So it's going to be like soybeans and sorghum and live hogs.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, who wants all that stuff anyway?
Yeah.
Sorghum, that's all GMO stuff, man. Give it to them. Sell it to them. Yeah. Well, it'll be fun. I mean, this is just business, right? This is just business.
Well, I've said to those who have suggested that we're in a trade war, or that we're going to get in a trade war, forgive me, by imposing these tariffs, I suggest that we're in a trade war. We have been, and we're losing dramatically. So there it is.
Because we're always in a trade war, right, Andrew?
That's what it is.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you consider, you know, that they say, okay, China, you can make steel with no environmental regulations, no worker safety regulations, no regulations of any kind. And the U.S., so you have to have all these OSHA and FICA and FUI, all these requirements that you must meet, and all these worker safety initiatives and all this, then, so we're going to tie your hands behind your back, and then you got to go compete with the Chinese who have no such regulation. I really haven't met too many people who suggest that we dismantle all regulatory framework around U.S. corporations. I mean, that seems insane. But that if you don't do that, they can't compete fairly with a Chinese company. You can't put all these regulatory burdens on a U.S. company and expect them to be competitive. So protective tariffs are the only choice. If you don't put a tariff in place, then you accept the fact that China is continuing to pollute the world by making steel without the same regulatory framework that the U.S. companies have.
Well, there could be a day, though, that I guess in China, the people just start dying off so much that they got to stop.
Well, they got to wear masks now. I don't know, but I do know that the very same people that are opposed to tariffs are the folks that would recoil, in fact, be horrified if we suggested that we should drop all environmental and worker safety regulations from the U.S. books and allow corporations to do whatever they please so that they can make steel cheaper and compete with the Chinese. We don't want to go backwards, do we? So why would we let a foreign country and a company subvert our regulatory framework by moving the bulk of the production offshore? That seems like counterproductive to me.
Well, I wish I still had the tape, but when we had that little crash about a year ago, I lost it with, got to get it back with Ross Perot and the sucking sound tape. And and he was right, you know, he was really right. And that's, you don't hear that people say, the people like you, they don't really... you know, they don't really talk much about it. I don't know. I guess President Trump, though, has. I mean, he's certainly been very clear that he thought NAFTA was
Bad.
And
bad
they're,
deal.
They're renegotiating it right now, right?
We should, and they should. No doubt we should renegotiate it. And again, I point to the proof as the first instance where a U.S. company has made a mega revenue from a foreign entity and is now going to be taxed in the United States, so that we'll enjoy that revenue into the U.S. Treasury, and the European treasuries won't see any. So first instance, and what do they do? You know, come on. So you don't think they are operating in their best interest? Seems as though all of these deals that we've made over the last several decades have been not in the interest of the United States. So the NAFTA deal was in the best interest of Canada and Mexico. The U.S. didn't really see anything from it. And we've got the decades behind it to prove it. So.
If you'd like to be on the show this morning, call and say hi, 888-663-6386. Email Patrick, oneradionetwork.com. So it looks like then this fiscal year, they're going to do, a 1.3?
Deficit?
Yeah, spending bill. Is this separate from their budget? I'm confused what that means. And they're in a compromise on a 1.3 omnibus spending bill.
All included.
Does that mean the budget for fiscal 2018?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure how far this spending bill goes, but that is the problem, right?
They're trying to do the dock and the wall thing and all that.
Correct, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like, okay, here we go again. But curiously, if you look at the chart, the caps in the gross national debt are the only thing that's given us plateaus, you know, from like fiscal 12 to the beginning of fiscal 14, or when we hit the first debt ceiling in that decade, you see the flattening out in the period where we hit the debt ceiling. It's the only thing that has kept government in check all these years. Otherwise, from, you know, January 2012 to the present, do you realize that the national debt 15 years ago was like $5 trillion. And now it's 21? Come on. It's ridiculous. It's insane.
What's the interest rate on, 21? It probably averages 3%, something like that, 2%?
Well, yeah, when you consider the fact that in order to get cheaper interest rates, they've funded 60% of our national debt in the short term.
Yeah.
You told us
we got $6 trillion coming due.
That's right.
By the time President Trump leaves office.
Now, you know, I guess that brings us to the Fed, because the Fed owns a lot of that debt. So the Fed just had $36 billion come due, and the government paid them. Excuse me. It was not 36. It was 36 plus 12. So that's 48. So it had $48 billion, nearly $50 billion come due at one shot. Well, the Fed rolled over 36 and then cashed out the other 12. So you remember I said the Fed can never sell off that bond holding, their bond holdings, and that's because the maturities are so high. But they said they were going to reduce by $10 billion a month. And this, it looks like, well, okay, they've done it twice. So now I'm starting to pay attention to the rate at which they're allowing their balance sheet to run off, meaning as a debt comes due, rather than using the proceeds to buy other treasury bonds, they're simply rolling a portion of it and cashing out a portion of it. So look at the Fed's balance sheet. We're actually down.
From the 4.5.
From the last report. Yeah. And so they're actually selling off or running off. They're allowing these securities to mature. I still don't think they're going to outright sell, although I don't know if you caught the commentary by the Fed governor of, who was that, Kansas City? I think that's who it was. The Fed governor of Kansas City is a woman. She's a non-voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee. So she could pretty much say what she wants. Her name is Esther George.
Yep.
Have you heard that name,
yes,
Esther George?
Mm-hmm.
So Esther George says, hey, this unwinding of the balance sheet is going too slow. It's building up financial imbalances. And then you can get her speech right from the Kansas City Fed. And, you know, she talks about, hey, we need to accelerate and actually start selling. So if you recall on previous shows, I've talked about the fact that the 40% of the Fed's holdings that is due 10 years out or more, you know, that's a big chunk of change. After they're done selling off the immediately liquid ones, they're going to, well, I shouldn't say selling because that's not what they're doing. Remember, they're running it off. So it comes due, they don't roll it over. But now when they get, those are gone, the only thing they have left are obligations that aren't due for another decade. So their only choice is to sell those. And to me, that's just a very dangerous place to go economically.
Well, has not Mr. Powell, the new guy, he suggested that we're going to have higher interest rates, and then he's going to be selling as well, right? I mean, that he has actually been quoted.
Correct.
Hasn't he?
Correct. Yeah.
Now, that would bring me to...
Well, you got to add those two together before you go there. Federal government running deficits of $1.5 trillion, and the Fed selling off $600 billion a year of its balance sheet, because that's their stated schedule.
That'd be $2 trillion, right?
$2 trillion, yeah. Mm-hmm. Scary number.
Yeah, $2 trillion. That would lead me to what I wanted to kind of bring up a little bit. So you've taught us that if you go back into, early 1900s, and they had this liquidity crisis. When was that? Right before World War II, right?
1896. I don't know which one you mean.
I think we're talking like the
1930s, crash of 29.
Before that, right before that. I have my notes here.
Panic of 1908.
Yeah, something like that.
Panic of 1908 was when J.P. Morgan said that Knickerbocker Trust did not have enough money to meet its obligations.
What is the one that really started World War II? What was that in about 1914?
Well, that would be World War One, right?
World War One. Yeah.
That's all right. Yeah. The closest one to that is the Panic of 1907.
Yeah. No. Here, the liquidity. I wrote some notes here. There was a liquidity crisis in the banks, right? And they did the League of Nations and all that.
Okay, that was 1916.
Yeah,
15,
right. And let us in right to World War One. Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Then we had the bubbles, and we said that liquidity crisis, that was a central bank choice.
Correct.
Okay, that was a choice. That's the point. It's a choice.
It wasn't a solvency crisis.
It was a choice.
It was a liquidity crisis.
Yeah, so they just kind of turned off the spigots, right? They said,
that's correct.
Let's do this. I guess that it was part and parcel then to get into the war?
Many have suggested that that was the case.
Okay.
You know, we had just created the Federal Reserve in
1913. Yeah, 1913, right.
And so with the Federal Reserve came the mobilization of credit. So because you had the Fed, then the Fed was free to mobilize the nation's credit by creating money. And so those foreign powers that got into the war to begin with knew that they could count on the U.S. Treasury to kind of fund the whole thing.
Right.
So
right. Yeah. So then with the liquidity crisis, you get into the war, and then we had, after the war, then we had the bubble, you taught us about the Roaring Twenties, right? And that was when interest rates were going up, right? They were raising interest rates.
In order to try to contain the inflation that they had
created. And then you had this massive Roaring Twenties. Huh?
Sure they roared. You had all that extra money in circulation.
And that was
much
a
the
controlled
same as,
thing, right?
So, well, and this is why the people that saw the QE they predicted inflation, hyperinflation, the same style that we had then. You know, the Fed can't create $4 trillion and put it into circulation without creating that sort of inflation, that sort of a bubble like the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah. So they had that. And then, of course, then you've taught us that then they did the Depression to kind of, you know, reboot that sucker, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the Great Depression. And then if you take the position, which I kind of do, that it's just really not all about the money for these people, right? I mean, there's something else going on. It is control, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's just not about the money. They can create all the money they want.
Yep.
Right? So it's not about the money. So they must use these things to, to keep us on our toes and to make more, I don't know, make more control? Or what is your take? Because I guess my point here, I'm taking a long time to get here, but it looks like then, is there something else afoot now? Is this the next big one right now? I don't want to get too dramatic on you, but with all this debt, with all the stuff going on, is there something else? Well, of course, we had the Great Recession. Do you think the boys have something else in mind now? Because there's a lot of really upside-down stuff going on.
Well, they're trying to give us a soft landing. You know, their unwinding of QE. If you recall, when all that started, I think it was, right before the president's election. And then June of 17, they announced the mechanics. And then I think around September, they announced the amounts. So it took them a year and a half to get there by really taking their time and letting the market sink in and understand that they were going to start unwinding their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So now they've got their $10 billion a month. By October of this year, they say they're going to be shedding $50 billion a month in securities, 30 in treasuries, 20 in MBS. So their plan to withdraw all of this money for circulation is, I don't know, it's akin to Russian roulette, I guess. Man, we hope that gun doesn't go off. Uh-huh. But, you know, any one of these rate increases, any one of these dumping of securities could spook the markets to the point that they just run away. So
household,
it seems,
household debt's $13 trillion, right?
Yeah.
QE, there was really no trickle down with all this new money, right?
No.
Since 07. There was
went into margin debt and
sucked it up. Right?
Yeah, stock and then they buybacks.
Low interest rates forever, and that has been a, people say, that which has fueled this stock market thing that we're experiencing right now, right?
It's
people
and
borrow
the
money at no, and bond market at no interest, and then they buy back their stocks, and we have corporate debt, which is more leveraged. You know, I saw they're more leveraged today, the corporations.
Than they were before the crisis?
Yeah, more leveraged. And what,
more.
What does that mean? To tell people what that means.
Well, it means that they've borrowed against the equity of their company at such a level that even if they sold the company, they couldn't pay the loan back.
There's my widgets. I need more money to...
Make more widgets,
but nobody wants my... I don't know. So what else? So there's a lot of things that are just kind of hanging out there. So if Powell would say, well, we're not going to QE anymore, right? And we're just going to sell our stuff. And, you know, they could create any kind of next event they wanted if they really wanted to clamp down the iron fist kind of velvet club thing, couldn't they?
Hey, you don't even want to think about that. I mean, you don't. Look at the CVS deal. Right? So the CVS is buying CVS Health, right? The drugstore.
Oh, buying Aetna?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Where are they getting the money?
At 0.25% or something, right?
Yeah, they got to borrow it. And so as the marketplace looks at their bond rating, it's like 2 points above junk. And they say, we're going to loan you $50 billion so you can take over Aetna.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, the marketplace jumped on it. They bought it, and not even thinking about whether or not CVS can pay back through its purchase of Aetna this enormous burden that it's taking on. It was so bad, in fact, that I'm pretty sure Moody's put them on credit watch and gave them a negative outlook. So if corporations start doing this or continue doing this sort of thing where they're so heavily leveraged, and the bond market, especially this junk bond market, continues to pay these outlandish rates of return. So junk bonds rated triple C or less, you know, the riskiest of them, is about 10.5%. So, and as investors chase this yield, they're taking larger and larger risks that are really, I mean, I can't believe it.
So it's the idea 10 years ago when my little market was going under because I overbuilt and had too many employees and all that, right? So I'd go out there and I'd say, okay, Andy, I need really $100,000 because, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to make it. But I just got to pay you. I have to pay you 10%. Okay.
Yeah.
And then Andy would say, okay, well, 10%, you'd be silly enough to do it. And you wouldn't, but
I'll take it.
You take it. You take the 10% because you believe that that's a good return. But then Patrick didn't really have a plan, right?
Just give me more money.
Just give me more money. I'm going to continue doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And hopefully
eventually it'll work.
It's going to work. These widgets, I don't have the margins, but if I sell more widgets.
Yeah, make it up in volume.
Are the bets that badly thought out today?
Well, yeah. Look, if we have something to compare to, you remember when oil went up to like $120 a barrel?
I do, 150.
Yeah. And so the majority of the bonds that were issued at that time, these less than stellar AAA bonds, were to the oil and gas industry.
Oh, at 150.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when that thing tanked, I think you had triple C credit up around 20%. So never mind 10, you need 20. And in 2008, when we were in the midst of the financial crisis, if you were bringing a triple C bond to the market, you were paying, ready for this?
Yeah.
40%.
Whoa.
Hey.
How would you pay that? I mean, how could a corporation pay that back?
Well, they don't have any plan to pay it back. They just need more money. Defaults were everywhere.
Yeah.
And even then, with a 40% margin, there were tremendous losses all across the board.
Uh-huh.
So now, in the most risky deal to the market at this point, they're looking for 10.5.
And the most risky now is?
Well, I think it was that CVS deal.
Yeah, sure, that kind of stuff, right?
That thing is crazy, man. Mm-hmm. That thing is absolutely.
Of course, if Jeff Bezos goes out and says, you know, I want to borrow $150 billion for Whole Foods, or I don't know, what did they pay for that?
I don't know.
I don't even remember. Whatever they paid for it. People are going to do it because...
Hey, it's Jeff Bezos.
And Amazon. They're almost a $1 trillion company. So
right.
I guess it kind of makes sense. You left... If you wanted to lend Jeff that much money, right?
Yeah, well, okay, so you've got
Are you saying no, you wouldn't lend Jeff?
No, I wouldn't.
I know you say, I'm not going to sell my gold and lend Jeff
no
money.
No way, not a chance in hell.
How much did Amazon pay for
Whole Foods?
I just Googled it here.
They paid all the money.
Ah, no, $14 billion. It was chump change, man.
Nothing like CVS deal.
Of course.
So at any rate, if you've got all of this corporate borrowing at these rates, which may or may not be too high, we don't know, you have the Fed unwinding its balance sheet, letting its bonds mature, and then canceling them out. And you have the Treasury running $1.2 trillion in deficits.
Man, I tell you what.
Woo, pretty soon we're talking real money, man.
Pretty soon. Well, maybe the boys they're going to control the satellites and all the TVs. Well, they do that already, newspapers, and just make up their own new economy. I mean, the world's going to get so wacky in the next 10, 20 years with what you can believe and what you can't believe. I mean, I think anything's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can have spend $10,000 for an imaginary thing in a lampshade, I mean, anything could happen.
You're right about
that.
You know
what I mean? Anything can happen. People are paying $10,000 for a bit thing.
Yeah, so if you're looking at market risk.
I mean, think about that. That's crazy.
So if many people are expecting some type of a cataclysmic event, and they point to things like, well, I mean, if you look at December 2016, where the Fed funds rate was versus where the 3-month Treasury yield was. So I think a 3-month Treasury bill a year ago was yielding 0.4%.
3 months a year ago. All right.
Yeah.
0.4%. So that's all you got back if you lent the Gov $1 million.
Correct.
0.4%.
0.4%.
Okay. That's a 3-month. Okay.
3-month Treasury yield.
Uh huh.
The 3-month Treasury yield spiked on Friday at 1.78.
And that tells us what?
Well, that tells us that the Fed funds rate is 1.25, 1.5. So the marketplace has said to the Fed, hey, we're a quarter point ahead of you in the marketplace. So rates have gone for the federal government to borrow money from Donald Trump's election date
right
to now, they've tripled.
Tripled, yeah.
Quadrupled, right? Mm-hmm. 1.78 versus 0.4. Yeah,
yeah. That's like your mortgage going from 4% to 12%.
Quadrupled.
No, or 16%.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
That's curious.
Yeah, and so the marketplace is already saying to the Fed, okay, we're ready for your quarter point rate hike. And now at the end of the meeting today, they'll go, okay, we're going to raise rates a quarter of a percent.
Because it's already baked in the cake.
And it's already done. So if you recall what I said, the tail wagging the dog, you know, the market is telling the Fed that it's time to raise interest rates, not the reverse.
Because people do not want to lend the gov, the one we love, money at that 0.4. They're not going to do it.
Of course not.
That's the point, right?
Of course not. I look at the 2-year, or more importantly, the 2-year, 10-year spread.
Yeah, that old spread thing, man.
Yeah.
I heard that flattening yield curve. I never really understood, but I like to say it because people think I know what I'm talking about.
Flattening is one thing. Inverted is quite another.
So you got a 2-year at what?
Well, you got the 2-year now at, like, I don't know, 2.3, and the 10-year at 2.85. That's a spread of, like, 50 basis points. There's nothing. So the short end of the market is telling the long end, hey, well, we've doubled. We've actually, if you look at the bottom of that market, what was that? 2013. So in the last 5 years, 2013, the 2-year treasury yield was 0.5. And now it's 2.5. 2.3.
I think we're 2.3.4 this morning. Just Googled it.
2.34?
Yeah, 2.35. Yeah.
2.35. So on Friday, it was 2.31.
Mm-hmm. So that's saying folks are less and less willing to lend the gov, the one we love, money.
Correct.
At that kind of puny rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the 2-year yield, if you look at past cycles, the 2-year yield is the one that tells you right away, I mean, when the rate hike is coming. So I think the 2-year market has told you that the Fed is going to raise interest rates. Well, from when the 10-year yield, when Mr. Trump took the election, was at 1.4. And now it's 2.85. Even the 10-year yield has doubled in the last year. So I don't know what people are thinking when they don't realize where we are in terms of the... It's like, it's almost, what do they call that, whistling past the graveyard? We don't care.
We don't care.
It doesn't matter. No. I think it matters heavily.
We don't care. Andrew Goss, Patrick Timpone, it's The Real World of Money. That might lead us into a little bit of a plug for your company. Because you have, I know, I've heard... that you have quit selling gold and silver coins and you're now only selling Bitcoin. Is that correct? I mean,
no.
I saw that on Facebook, so I'm pretty sure that's right because I saw it on the NSA website and they got it from Facebook, but that's another story we'll get to. But so you buy and sell gold and silver coins for a living.
American gold and silver coins, exclusively.
So how are you able to do that and make a living? Because who cares who buys gold and silver coins?
Well, it's the spread, obviously. I buy something for X and sell it for X plus a commission.
You old capitalist, you.
Yeah.
How do you do that?
So I make a market, a two-way market in which there's a spread between bid and ask, and I'm constantly in the marketplace buying and selling American rare coins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Coins
that have collectible value.
Oh, yeah. Significant rarities. Yep. Mm-hmm. I just bought a Civil War era proof gold dollar.
Did you know?
Perfect example. A coin that 50 of them were made and just a few survived. Mm-hmm. So it's just an example, but that's kind of the...
But they're not all... So they're not all kind of J.P. Getty kind of coins where you need $1 billion. You have some coins that are very, very popular of the...
10 or 20,000.
But you have some that the $20 gold pieces, the St. Gaudens, which are just a couple thousand, right?
Right, but those aren't super rarities.
No, they're not super rare.
Those are semi-numismatic coins where the bulk of their value is in the fact that they're a big one-ounce gold piece.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of people who are averse to the idea of paying $10,000 for a coin that has $1,000 worth of gold in it, I point to the semi-numismatic market. But to the knowledgeable, the coin that you buy that no one else can own puts you in the driver's seat. When you buy one of 50... And, you know, there's how many billion people on the planet, and you've got one of 50, That's a pretty safe bet that you have something that no one else can get.
Do you always find, there are always buyers for...
The rare ones?
The rare ones.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Isn't that curious? That there's just a certain amount of people, I guess, around the world. Do you think that percentage of people goes up in percentage-wise willing to pay? In other words... So somebody was going to invest a $10,000 coin with you today, and they think, well, maybe 10 years from now it might be worth, I don't know, 20?
Even if it's still worth 10, they're better off than
Of course. But I mean, just so they...
Well, that is part of the hope is for capital appreciation.
Right.
Capital preservation is another part. You just want to save what you have. You don't want to lose to inflation.
Because of what we know that boys do for a living, money, right?
You're being forced into the market to try to generate a return. Hmm. You're being forced to, because if you just park your money in the bank, you know, where are we today? Where's the dollar index today?
The dollar index? Oh, yeah. Hold on, my mouse is just ready to go there.
We started the year last year at 104. At the beginning of 2017.
Did we now?
Yeah, we did.
90.06.
And it's just like struggling to hold on to the 90.
Just trying to hold.
Just trying to hold the 90.
Hold on.
So already in the last 12, 14 months, we've lost greater than 10% of the value of the dollar. So if you're not out there generating a 10% return, if you just have your money sitting in the bank.
10%? Come on.
Yeah. If you're not generating a 10% return, you're not keeping up with the loss of purchasing power in the dollar just over the last year.
Really?
Is it going to accelerate? Yeah, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Is the inflation rate going to pick up? Yes, I think it is. Are interest rates going to drive those prices higher? Yes, I think they are. And into this, we're a bubble in the stock market, bubble in the bond market, bubble. And real estate prices are scaring the bejesus out of it. You're in Austin. You realize Austin's number 4 in the nation in terms of appreciating real estate values?
Really?
Values are up something like 120% in the last 4 years.
Yeah, but Austin's weird, you know, because it's kind of strange because we've got so many geeks and all of that.
Yeah, what about Oakland, California?
Is it
all? What's weird about that? Oakland is number 1. How about Dallas? You would think Dallas wouldn't be a tech hub, would it? But yet, Dallas's real estate prices are number 2 in the nationwide marketplace in terms of increase.
It's because everybody wants to live in Texas. But I mean, mortgage
6.7% nationwide last year.
Yes. Wow.
So that's back. I mean, if you consider during the housing crisis, the people lost confidence in real estate as an investment. So point I'm trying to make is that just nearly every single asset class in the last 10 years has just gone straight up. Every one of them is approaching really crazy levels. And so where do you put your money? What is a reasonable place to put your money? This is not... a bad problem to have, but it's a problem many people do have. If you can't pace inflation, you're losing money.
So you say a good place to do it is commodities.
Gold and silver coins.
Gold and silver coins,
For me, I think gold and silver coins are the best. But, you know, someone paid $450 million for a Leonardo da Vinci painting. You know, there's a case of owning something no one else can have. They're paying record prices at the Barrett Jackson Auto Auction for classic automobiles. Old guitars are trading for record prices. So limited supply, increasing demand items, which have not enjoyed this ballooning asset value over the last decade, I think it's their time again. So if you have any kind of collectible, any kind of an antique, any kind of a rare item, you're probably going to see dramatic price increases over the coming decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, people say, well, you know, I have my money in like a Vanguard thing, and
I look on
today, and you know that they're the biggest owner of Facebook stock Vanguard.
Yeah,
Vanguard, and you know they went faceplant went down 10% in the last week because of this whole.
Using of the data thing?
Secrecy thing. 10%. Mark the Zuck lost, God love him, $9 billion in the last few days.
He might have to stop building the fence.
That was a bad day at the office for the Zuck.
He might have to stop building his wall. You know, the Hawaiians are really mad at Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, because he did a whole thing, right?
Yeah, he's building a wall around his estate.
I think in Kauai, too, which is
the Garden Island.
It's like a sick thing.
He's like, what are you doing? You can't do that. You can't just build this giant brick wall. Well, you got to keep the riffraff out, he says, but don't build a border wall. No. Goodness, no.
Isn't that surprising that Vanguard is the number one holder in faceplant stock?
No.
No, you're not surprised?
I'm not.
Some of the other ones. Can you name some of the other ones?
Institutional investors.
BlackRock.
Yeah, BlackRock.
State Street. These are the boys, right?
Institutional.
Morgan Stanley.
Institutional.
New York Mellon. J.P. Morgan. Yeah. UBS. These are the boys' own faceplant.
Correct.
Right?
And it's because rather than buy faceplant themselves, an individual investor gives the money to these guys and tells them, okay, I'm in your stock fund. I'm in your bond fund. I'm in your whatever trust.
Right.
So those that fail to study history, remember that Santayana saying?
Yeah, baby.
If you study where people had their money in the crash of 1929, that's what you'll find, that they had given their money to middlemen who these giant funds controlled huge segments of the marketplace. So what happens if all of a sudden Vanguard decides, sell?
Whoa.
We're out. Sell.
Faceplant goes down 20%.
Yeah, or
because they got 169 million shares.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
But they also have a lot of money under management that they're forced to buy something, and they try to just pick the next hottest thing. Unfortunately, you know, the bonds are, I think, much worse than that. As the bond rates go up and people start withdrawing their money from the bond funds, the bond funds are forced to sell their most liquid assets.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say they take the $1 trillion that people have given them and they divide it up and they put 10% into short bills and notes and 50% into 30-year obligations and everything else is in the middle. And people start saying, we need our money. We want to cash out of this bond fund. Well, the first thing they sell are their short-term securities. But when they're gone, then they're left with these long-rated, long-maturing bonds that they cannot cash except by selling them in the marketplace. And that's when the real pain of these funds will be felt.
So I just did the math. It's $29 billion that Vanguard has in faceplant stock.
More than Whole Foods.
$29 billion.
Yeah.
That's a lot of bananas. You know, the curious thing about these, do you recall that a thing called MySpace?
Yeah, sure.
Right?
The original Facebook.
I mean, they were like the bomb before Facebook came in. And now you're seeing, I saw some numbers and it's pretty startling. And maybe there's this Facebook karma coming down. But, you know, I don't wish these guys well. I mean, Zuck did fine. Thank you very much. But, and we use Facebook, but... The kids are not even into Facebook anymore.
No,
they have left Facebook long ago.
Oh,
man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because Facebook is tone deaf. They're
apps. Yeah. I mean, they're doing Snapchat and stuff. I don't know what it is. Do you?
Yeah.
And Twitter, Snapchat, and
different platforms.
Different platforms.
Yeah.
And, you know, this thing could go away like, you know.
Like MySpace.
Like MySpace. They could say, bye.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do something else.
Well, especially if they do something like allow a private company to harvest their data. See, and this is the thing.
Okay, well, now you're just uncovering a story here that people don't know what's going on.
Uh-oh.
So we're going to do a commercial first, and then you're going to tell them what Mr. Zuckerberg has got himself into.
Ew.
He didn't learn this at Harvard.
No, he didn't.
Hold on. Previously, with research scientists at MIT, Stephanie Seneff, Ph.D., and the curious connections between these glyphosates, Roundup, GMOs, and sulfur.
So if you simply put the glyphosate in place of the glycine in the sulfur transferase, you will not be able to get the sulfate from the cholesterol sulfate to some other molecule, such as the heparin sulfate. The cell won't be able to defend itself with sulfate if it can't put the sulfate there. But it's really, really important to be able to do that because, for example, cholesterol sulfate, it delivers sulfate to the cells. But in order to deliver it, you've got to take the sulfate off of the cholesterol and put it on something else. And that's where the sulfur transferase would come in and wouldn't be able to do that.
I know, gets a little geeky, but the point is that without the proper amount of sulfur in the body, and now it's being disrupted because of the GMOs, even more than what it was already doing, it's not good. So we think that this sulfur product that we've been promoting is really helping people to keep everything kind of working well, because this whole sulfur cycle is kind of God's way of keeping the bad guys out and exiting the body. And because our sulfur is absolutely pure with no additives, it's different from almost all the other ones out there. You can click an order, three prices, right on our website, oneradionetwork.com. Your body's little electronic transport system really needs sulfur to do this. Vitamin B conversion requires sulfur. Synthesizing very important metabolic things like glutathione, which is huge, right? The liver produces that, requires sulfur. Proper insulin function. There could be people that are woefully low on sulfur because they don't like sulfur foods, and they're just eating like, you know, whatever, regular old store-bought stuff that has no sulfur in it because of the soils and the chemicals and stuff, and they could have cattywampus blood sugar. The insulin thing requires sulfur. I mean, there's so many things that could be included. Now, we're not making medical claims saying if you take sulfur, well, then you're going to just get rid of your, diabetes too and all of that stuff. But, a lot of people feel really better when they start doing this, and they keep buying it. And we've been selling it for, I think, 4 years now. Andy gets it at 9 pounds at a clip. You get a nice discount there. And if you'd like more than 4 pounds, email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, or 2 pounds, just order away right on the website.
My name is John Kunkel. I'm 63 years old, and I've been building muscle and losing fat over the last 6 months. I've been using One World Whey to provide a highly assimilable protein and Kappa Mineral Whey to help me get all the minerals I need and support my body's alkaline pH. I've also been using EstroBlock to keep my testosterone levels high and not allow it to convert to estrogen, which happens normally as men age. The extra testosterone also helps in building muscle. The result has been a successful process of converting my body from fat to muscle. I've lost 20 pounds to date.
Join the many people who are converting fat to muscle with One World Whey. The body is chronically hungry for usable amino acids. Cooking proteins destroys up to 75% of the amino acids. Cooked proteins burden the body and accelerate aging. One World Whey's protein content is raw and virtually 100% usable. Substitute One World Whey for one meal of your day and see how much better you can feel. Click an order on the One World Whey banner ad right here at OneRadioNetwork.com. That's OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are repopulating our store since Patrick had some Amazon karma he didn't know from. I don't know where I got that, because maybe the I've always been kind and gentle with Amazon. I really loved them and stuff, and I don't know. But maybe it was a past life. Who knows? Oh, but they weren't even around. Well, I have to figure that out. Anyway, they cut us off because we said something like, over the years, shop through Amazon and support ourselves. That's it. So we are repopulating, however, with things that we think are even better than a lot of the stuff you're going to find on Amazon. And you can look in our store and check it out. We have a lot of Ken Rollers things there. You can get this water vitalizer and structure your water and actually raise the pH. I've proven with a little real professional pH meter, my rainwater has gone from 5.5 to 7.5. And the water geeks say that's the ideal pH of water. So I was doing it, didn't even know it, just by using the Vitalizer Plus. So you can, we think this is a pretty cool way to get some nifty water in your body by getting a distilling machine off the interweb, and you can get one for a couple $100, a good one. Distill that sucker, you know, your drinking water, your street water, we call it, wherever you live, and then get the Vitalizer Plus and structure it and put some minerals in right there, or the mineral cube, organic minerals, and you're looking at nice water, 7.5 pH around that, maybe even a little bit more. And also, and it's all cleaned up. There's no yuck stuff in there. So it's kind of a cool thing to do. And we think that's a nice way that you can get some good water. You can either go in our store and you see a little link on the top of the page, and you'll see it up there. And it is Ken Rolla's Water Vitalizer Plus. He's got a lot of good products there.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com. Good morning. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. The telephone number is 888-663-6386. Email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com.
Okay, those are a couple of numbers. Well, one number, and you can use that number and say hi to Andy, ask a question, a comment. 888-663-6386. And as the lady said, email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Andrew Goss, currency historian. His number in SDL, New Jersey, or South Carolina is 800-468-2646. 800-468-2646. Care to buy, dip your toe in the water. They also have some really cool CDs, Protecting Your Wealth, all about the Fed, and some things they'll send you books and stuff, and you know, that kind of thing. And the only thing they won't do is knock on your door and want to sell you gold coin. Yeah, like, no salesman will call, right?
Yeah, I like that one. That's my favorite.
No salesman will call. Hello, would you like to buy some siding?
No, a salesman might call. Do you want to buy some siding? No. Okay, thank you. Goodbye. That should be the end of it. But if you've ever gotten one of these guys on the phone and you yell and scream and say, I'm not interested, I'm not interested, I'm not interested, and they say something like, well, I can see you're undecided. I'll call you back tomorrow, and I'll hound you until you finally agree. I hate that as a model, and we don't do that.
Yeah, so, we don't do that.
Yeah, we occasionally call, but if you
when
say
you have
no,
something to sell, right?
Yeah, if you say no, we're not going to hound you into submission.
Well, see, I think that's really cool. Part of your model that you've done is where you keep track of the coins that you sell.
That's what's
like,
important.
Like, say you sold Patrick a 1912 Zippity Doodah, you know, for $10,000 10 years ago. You know that I have it.
That's right.
And so somebody calls you up and say, "Hey, I want one of those 1912 Zippity Doodahs," and say, "Well, I think I can get you one."
That's right.
So you call Patrick and say, "Hey,
hey,
what do you
remember
think?
That Zippity Doodah you bought?
You want to go to Hawaii for a year or something?
Yep. That's right.
You want to sell the Zippity Doodah?
That's exactly right.
What do you want to do?"
And so we have an inventory resource that our competition doesn't have, because they're just out there to sell coins. They don't care who they sell them to,
and they don't know where
they go
sell
after
them, right?
That.
Right. That's pretty cool. I like
it's
it.
The difference.
How'd you come up with that?
Well, from the marketplace. So when we started this company in 1981, we had just come off that run from 77 to 80. 77, 78, 79, we're telling people, buy coins, and maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But by 1980, the big problem is answering the phone, you know, kidding. So many people wanted to buy, and there just wasn't enough product. And so that's when we came up with the concept that, hey, if we place inventory with known investors, not collectors, investors who are willing to hold it and sell it when their profit is right, then we would have an inventory resource that no one else would have. And boy, that really is the key to our model. And obviously, as prices rise, and folks that bought the coins 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago recognize that they need to sell at some point, or maybe they're putting them away for the kids, which that happens a lot. But we're here, and we're ready. And that's the difference between us and a typical company.
Well, that's why we like you.
Thank you.
That's why we like you. That's why
we like to
you.
Be liked. Huh. Yeah.
Okay, let's get into to Faceplant. I love that.
Oh
name.
My goodness.
So, give us the short story of what went on and why they've taken this 10% stock hit in the last week. What kind of news came out? Do you know the story on this?
Yeah.
I'm not real clear exactly what happened.
Well, you have to go back to Obama 1.
Mm-hmm.
You remember when President Obama first ran for office, and his use of social media was touted as one of the reasons why he was successful in getting his message out. And he was getting his message out by an organic use of entities like Facebook. Well, along came people who realized, well, there's all this data sitting there, and Facebook gives us access to it. So why shouldn't we use it for something like election use? They were looking for ways to monetize all of this data that they had. So they did. They started giving or selling user data to third parties without the user's knowledge. And the Federal Trade Commission said, wait a minute. No. You can't just give people's information away without their consent. And so they entered into a consent decree way back in 2010, in which Facebook said, okay, we'll get the user's consent before we change their privacy settings. Ah, the privacy settings have to do with who sees your posts. And so if I wanted to see, for example, everyone who liked a pro-NRA post, and I could get that data. And so Facebook started allowing more and more companies access to their data and found it as a way that they could monetize their platform. Well, the FTC said, you can't just randomly change people's privacy settings so that now all of a sudden you can see all of their friends and everything their friends do. You have to ask for permission. And if you don't, we're going to fine you $40,000 per day per violation. Now, since there's 50 million victims in this latest scandal, spread over how many days, you could do some math and realize, holy cow, if they violated that consent decree, they're going to have to pay up billions of dollars in FTC fines.
Wow, so they've actually perhaps broken a law or two?
Yes. Well, Facebook says, heck no, we did not violate that consent decree. And privacy and data protections are fundamental to every decision that we make. So while the rest of America doesn't really realize it yet, what Facebook has done is they gave access to this user data to this firm, this infamous London firm, through an intermediary. And the intermediary was a professor who said, hey, I want to do a study of whatever it is. And so Facebook said to him or them, yeah, you go ahead and take our data. Well, unbeknownst to Facebook, they say, Cambridge Analytica, which is a London company, British company, that its business model is to use this data to micro-target individuals. And that's what they did. They got the data from the professor and then used it to help President Trump reach people without the media. Well, they used it also for President Obama and actually, before Trump had them, it was Ted Cruz. So these tactics, which people aren't used to, effectively using your Facebook information to solicit you and your friends, that's the key, is that every individual who consents takes with them 350, I think, users who didn't consent.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, Joe's your friend, Ralph's your friend, Frank's your friend. And when you consider the voter turnout in the United States is stuck at somewhere around 50%, that means half the people don't vote. How can you reach them? Well, they're on Facebook. So you go there and get their name and their preferences. I mean, you think about all the things that Facebook gathers about you and then effectively sells without your knowledge. So they're collecting every bit of personal data that it can, how you react to things, what your preferences are, what your choices are, your physical appearance, your pictures. I mean, any bit of data that they can gather on you, they'll gather it and then give it over to companies that sift through it, mine it, they call. And when they're done mining it, they're going to come up with a list, and these are likely voters, or these are people that agree with your philosophies, or worse still, you can change and alter your philosophies based upon what your audience wants to hear.
Hmm, yeah.
Boy, isn't that like dream food for a politician? And so to realize that Facebook has been using all of the data it collects on people to inform political campaigns on how they should structure their platform and who they should target for inclusion. This is coming as a shock to people. I'm shocked. I didn't realize that Facebook is sharing my data. And when they find out that it's sharing it with, oh, the deadly evil Trump. How? You know, when Obama did it, I guess it was okay. But now it's not. And they've got millions and millions of listeners, of interactors that they now have this data on. And it turns out that this data analytica thing had kept data on 50 million users without Facebook's consent.
And that's illegal, like a sick bird?
Well it's in violation of, again, a consent decree that Facebook entered into way, way back when they got caught doing this in the first place, which was sharing their people's information without their consent, without their knowledge. And, well, who's, you know, we've already talked about, I think the FTC, you can look into the Bloomberg, because you know Bloomberg, but the FTC has opened an investigation into whether Facebook violated this consent decree. And if they did, man, it's going to be the end of it. I mean, really. And I think if people start...
The end of what? Facebook?
Facebook, yeah.
Really?
Well, when people realize, geez, Facebook's selling all my information. They're selling the names of my friends and you know, what they like and don't like. I'm going to delete my account. Now, they can't delete the previous information that they've given Facebook, nor can they stop them from using that information. But if they decide that, well, we're not going to use an account, not going to sign in anytime, then you'll see Facebook subscribers start to fall. And if they're found in violation of this consent decree and the FTC starts fining them hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, you could see, an exodus from that Facebook.
Well, as we just said, though, the boys really own Facebook. So why would they do that? Why would they allow the, you know, anything really bad to happen to them?
Yeah, you're right. I mean,
you know,
in public, they find people and they you know, make and then behind the scenes, it's good job.
Whatever.
Make sure you give us that data next.
So what would be a few billion to deduct, right? I mean,
right.
Just fine them and slap their hand and go.
You remember Arthur Anderson, right?
Yeah, sure.
That was a big accounting firm.
Same deal.
Yeah. Now who is it? Where's Arthur Anderson now?
I don't know.
It's gone, Patrick.
Oh, you mean it's gone?
It's gone.
So is AIG, right?
Yeah, this could be a company killer.
Oh, so if they wanted to just stab it, they could do it.
Well, yeah, they most certainly could.
And as we conjectured at the beginning of the show, it's really not about money for these people, right?
No.
Maybe the boys think that Facebook is just too dangerous. You know,
that's right.
Just too much information out there about what we're doing, or
and the power that that a Facebook community has when they without getting they do it themselves, do it on their own. Look at the social movement with the kids and the gun control and all that.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, now this is something the boys can't control when the crowd gets rowdy and they have a platform like Facebook to share and to and to get other people also riled up.
Right.
If it's gone, well,
that's a good point. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just thinking about that that show, The Man in the High Castle. I mean, think about it. If they had faceplant back in the 60s and
couldn't get away with it.
You couldn't get away with it. I mean, you know, you couldn't get away with it. And what's going on, like you say, with the whole gun thing and then the Florida thing and
people are using it and the Trump thing and the argument now that holy cow, what you're saying is without this Cambridge Analytica, without this data, without this massive mining operation that the Trump campaign put on, then we wouldn't have a Trump presidency. Well, we got to
kill that
kill this
sucker
thing, man.
You know, that's interesting. And also
or we put some rules in place that make it impossible for a Trump to ever do this again.
Sure.
Because this is what he did, by the way. His main contributor was actually Ted Cruz's main contributor. Is a guy named Richard or Robert Mercer. Mm-hmm. Mercer is the last name. And he was a huge contributor to the Ted Cruz campaign and had steered Ted Cruz to Cambridge Analytica and use this company. They'll give you the data. Use this data to reach these people and tell them this, because this is what has proven to get them riled up. And that's how Ted Cruz managed to get himself to a position where he was.
Really?
Then when the Mercer crowd switched and went to Donald Trump, brought that whole... you know, a mindset to the Trump campaign. Well, that's when the deal was sealed. And, you know, given what happened and how it happened, it remain to be seen whether Facebook can emerge from this without additional regulation. But if you wanted to see Mark Zuckerberg grilled by Congress, you'll get to see that. That'll be a good thing. You'll get to see that. You see how he reacts when he's under the gun. And I just hope he doesn't do like that Skakel guy with with the pharmaceutical drugs. You know, start being, petulant. and denying the goodness. You could wind up with regulations that would hamper Facebook forever.